but you cannot move it from the sensation of a chair. The notion of a separate thinker, of an I, distinct from the experience, comes from memory and from the rapidity with which thought changes. It is like whirling a burning stick to give the illusion of a continuous circle of fire. If you imagine that memory is a direct knowledge of the past, rather than a present experience, you get the illusion of knowing the past and the present at the same time. This suggests that there is something in you distinct from both the past and the present experiences. You reason, I know this present experience, and it is different from that past experience. If I can compare the two and notice that experience has changed, I must be something constant and apart. But, as a matter of fact, you cannot compare this present experience with a past experience. You can only compare it with a memory of the past, which is a part of the present experience. When you see clearly that memory is a form of present experience, it will be obvious that trying to separate yourself from this experience is as impossible as trying to make your teeth bite themselves. There is simply experience. There is not something or someone experiencing experience. You do not feel feelings, think thoughts, or sense sensations any more than you hear hearing, see sight, or smell smelling. I feel fine means that a fine feeling is present. It does not mean that there is one thing called an I and another separate thing called a feeling, so that when you bring them together, this I feels the fine feeling. There are no feelings but present feelings, and whatever feeling is present is I. No one ever found an I apart from some present experience, or some experience apart from an I, which is only to say that the two are the same thing. As a mere philosophical argument, this is a waste of time. We are not trying to have an intellectual discussion. We are being aware of the fact that any separate I who thinks thoughts and experiences experience is an illusion. To understand this is to realize that life is entirely momentary, that there is neither permanence nor security, and that there is no I which can be protected. There is a Chinese story of one who came to a great sage saying, "I have no peace of mind. Please pacify my mind." The sage answered, "Bring out your mind, your I, before me, and I will pacify it." "These many years," he replied, "I have sought my mind, but I cannot find it." "There," concluded the sage, "it is pacified." The real reason why human life can be so utterly exasperating and frustrating is not because there are facts called death, pain, fear, or hunger. The madness of the thing is that when such facts are present, we circle, buzz, writhe, and whirl, trying to get the I out of the experience. We pretend that we are amoebas and try to protect ourselves from life by splitting in two. Sanity, wholeness, and integration lie in the realization that we are not divided, that man and his present experience are one, and that no separate I or mind can be found. While the notion that I am separate from my experience remains, there is confusion and turmoil. Because of this, there is neither awareness nor understanding of experience, and thus no real possibility of assimilating it. To understand this moment, I must not try to be divided from it. I must be aware of it with my whole being. This, like refraining from holding my breath for 10 minutes, is not something I should do. In reality, it is the only thing I can do. Everything else is the insanity of attempting the impossible. To understand music, you must listen to it. But so long as you are thinking, "I am listening to this music," you are not listening. To understand joy or fear, you must be wholly and undividedly aware of it. So long as you are calling it names and saying, "I am happy," or "I am afraid," you are not being aware of it. Fear, pain, sorrow, and boredom must remain problems if we do not understand them. But understanding requires a single and undivided mind. This surely is the meaning of that strange saying, "If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light." 6. The Marvelous Moment. You are listening to a song. Suddenly I ask, at this moment, who are you? How will you answer this question immediately and spontaneously, without stopping to find words? If the question does not shock you out of listening, you will answer by humming the song. If the question surprised you, you will answer, at this moment, who are you? But if you stop to think, you will try to tell me, not about this moment, but about the past. I shall get information about your name and address, your business and personal history. But I asked who you are, not who you were. For to be aware of reality, of the living present, is to discover that at each moment, the experience is all. There is nothing else beside it. No experience of you experiencing the experience. Even in our most apparently self-conscious moments, the self of which we are conscious is always some particular feeling or sensation of muscular tensions, of warmth or cold, of pain or irritation, of breath or of pulsing blood. There is never a sensation of what senses sensations, just as there is no meaning or possibility in the notion of smelling one's nose or kissing one's own lips. In times of happiness and pleasure, we are usually ready enough to be aware of the moment and to let the experience be all. In such moments, we forget ourselves, and the mind makes no attempt to divide itself from itself, to be separate from experience. But with the arrival of pain, whether physical or emotional, whether actual or anticipated, the split begins, and the circle goes round and round. As soon as it becomes clear that I cannot possibly escape from the reality of the present, since I is nothing other than what I know now, this inner turmoil must stop. No possibility remains but to be aware of pain, fear, boredom, or grief in the same complete way that one is aware of pleasure. The human organism has the most wonderful powers of adaptation to both physical and psychological pain. But these can only come into full play when the pain is not being constantly re-stimulated by this inner effort to get away from it, to separate the I from the feeling. The effort creates a state of tension in which the pain thrives. But when the tension ceases, mind and body begin to absorb the pain as water reacts to a blow or cut. There is another story of a Chinese sage who was asked, "How shall we escape the heat?" Meaning, of course, the heat of suffering. He answered, "Go right into the middle of the fire." "But how then shall we escape the scorching flame? No further pain will trouble you." We do not need to go as far as China. The same idea comes in The Divine Comedy, where Dante and Virgil find that the way out of hell lies at its very center. In moments of great joy, we do not, as a rule, stop to think, "I am happy," or "This is joy." Ordinarily, we do not pause to think thoughts of this kind until the joy is past its peak, or unless there is some anxiety that it will go away. At such times, we are so aware of the moment that no attempt is made to compare its experience with other experiences. For this reason, we do not name it, for names, which are not mere exclamations, are based on comparisons. Joy is distinguished from sorrow by contrast, by comparing one state of mind with the other. Had we never known joy, it would be impossible to identify sorrow as sorrow. But in reality, we cannot compare joy with sorrow. Comparison is possible only by the very rapid alternation of two states of mind, and you cannot switch back and forth between the genuine feelings of joy and sorrow as you can shift your eyes between a cat and a dog. Sorrow can only be compared with the memory of joy, which is not at all the same thing as joy itself. Like words, memories never really succeed in catching reality. Memories are somewhat abstract, being a knowledge about things rather than of things. Memory never captures the essence, the present intensity, the concrete reality of an experience. It is, as it were, the corpse of an experience from which the life has vanished. What we know by memory, we know only at second hand. Memories are dead because fixed. The memory of your deceased grandmother can only repeat what your grandmother was. But the real present grandmother could always do or say something new, and you were never absolutely sure what she would do next. There are then two ways of understanding an experience. The first is to compare it with the memories of other experiences, and so to name and define it. That is to interpret it in accordance with the dead and the past. The second is to be aware of it as it is, as when, in the intensity of joy, we forget past and future. Let the present be all, and thus do not even stop to think, I am happy. Both ways of understanding have their uses, but they correspond to the difference between knowing a thing by words and knowing it immediately. A menu is very useful, but it is no substitute for the dinner. A guidebook is an admirable tool, but it is hardly to be compared with the country it describes. The point, then, is that when we try to understand the present by comparing it with memories, we do not understand it as deeply as when we are aware of it without comparison. This, however, is usually the way in which we approach unpleasant experiences. Instead of being aware of them as they are, we try to deal with them in terms of the past. The frightened or lonely person begins at once to think, I am afraid, or I'm so lonely. This is, of course, an attempt to avoid the experience. We don't want to be aware of this present, but as we cannot get out of the present, our only escape is into memories. Here, we feel on safe ground, for the past is the fixed and the known, but also, of course, the dead. Thus, to try to get out of, say, fear, we endeavor at once to be separate from it and to fix it by interpreting it in terms of memory, in terms of what is already fixed and known. In other words, we try to adapt ourselves to the mysterious present by comparing it with the remembered past, by naming and identifying it. This would be all very well if you were trying to get away from something from which you can get away. It is a useful process for knowing when to come in out of the rain, but it does not tell you how to live with things from which you cannot get away, which are already part of yourself. Your body does not eliminate poisons by knowing their names. To try to control fear or depression or boredom by calling them names is to resort to superstition of trust in curses and invocations. It is so easy to see why this does not work. Obviously, we try to know, name, and define fear in order to make it objective, that is, separate from I. But why are we trying to be separate from fear? Because we are afraid. In other words, fear is trying to separate itself from fear, as if one could fight fire with fire. And this is not all. The more we accustom ourselves to understanding the present in terms of memory, the unknown by the known, the living by the dead, the more desiccated and embalmed, the more joyless and frustrated life becomes. So protected from life, man becomes a sort of mollusk, encrusted in a hard shell of tradition, so that when at last reality breaks through, as it must, the tide of pent-up fear runs wild. If, on the other hand, you are aware of fear, you realize that because this feeling is now yourself, escape is impossible. You see that calling it fear tells you little or nothing about it, for the comparison and the naming is based not on past experience, but on memory. You have then no choice but to be aware of it with your whole being as an entirely new experience. Indeed, every experience is in this sense new, and at every moment of our lives we are in the midst of the new and the unknown. At this point, you receive the experience without resisting it or naming it, and the whole sense of conflict between I and the present reality vanishes. For most of us, this conflict is ever gnawing within us, because our lives are one long effort to resist the unknown, the real present in which we live, which is the unknown in the midst of coming into being. Living thus, we never really learn to live with it. At every moment, we are cautious, hesitant, and on the defensive, and all to no avail. For life thrusts us into the unknown willy-nilly, and resistance is as futile and exasperating as trying to swim against a roaring torrent. The art of living in this predicament is neither careless drifting on the one hand, nor fearful clinging to the past and the known on the other. It consists in being completely sensitive to each moment, in regarding it as utterly new and unique, in having the mind open and wholly receptive. This is not a philosophical theory, but an experiment. One has to make the experiment to understand that it brings into play altogether new powers of adaptation to life, of literally absorbing pain and insecurity. It is as hard to describe how this absorption works as to explain the beating of one's heart or the formation of genes. The open mind does this as most of us breathe, without being able to explain it at all. The principle of the thing is clearly something like judo, the gentle, ju, wei, do, of mastering an opposing force by giving into it. The natural world gives us many examples of the great effectiveness of this way. The Chinese philosophy, of which judo itself is an expression, Taoism, drew attention to the power of water to overcome all obstacles by its gentleness and pliability. It showed how the supple willow survives the tough pine in a snowstorm. For whereas the unyielding branches of the pine accumulate snow until they crack, the springy boughs of the willow bend under its weight, drop the snow, and jump back again. If, when swimming, you are caught in a strong current, it is fatal to resist. You must swim with it and gradually edge to the side. One who falls from a height with stiff limbs will break them, but if he relaxes like a cat, he will fall safely. A building without give in its structure will easily collapse in storm or earthquake, and a car without the cushioning of tires and springs will soon come apart on the road. The mind has just the same powers, for it has give and can absorb shocks like water or a cushion. But this giving way to an opposing force is not at all the same thing as running away. A body of water does not run away when you push it. It simply gives at the point of the push and encloses your hand. A shock absorber does not fall down like a bowling pin when struck. It gives, and yet it stays in the same place. To run away is the only defense of something rigid against an overwhelming force. Therefore, the good shock absorber has not only give, but also stability or weight. This weight is likewise a function of the mind, and appears in the much misunderstood phenomenon of laziness. Significantly enough, nervous and frustrated people are always busy, even in being idle, such idleness being the laziness of fear, not of rest. But the mind-body is a system which conserves and accumulates energy. While doing this, it is properly lazy. When the energy is stored, it is just as happy to move, and yet to move skillfully, along the line of least resistance. Thus, it is not only necessity, but also laziness, which is the mother of invention. One may observe the unhurried, heavy movements of a skillful laborer at some hard task, and even in going against gravity, the good mountaineer uses gravity, taking slow, heavy strides. He seems to tack up the slope, like a sailboat against the wind. In the light of these principles, how does the mind absorb suffering? It discovers that resistance and escape, the I process, is a false move. The pain is inescapable, and resistance as a defense only makes it worse. The whole system is jarred by the shock. Seeing the impossibility of this course, it must act according to its nature, remain stable and absorb. To remain stable is to refrain from trying to separate yourself from a pain because you know that you cannot. Running away from fear is fear. Fighting pain is pain. Trying to be brave is being scared. If the mind is in pain, the mind is pain. The thinker has no other form than his thought. There is no escape. But so long as you are not aware of the inseparability of thinker and thought, you will try to escape. From this follows, quite naturally, absorption. It is no effort. The mind does it by itself. Seeing that there is no escape from the pain, the mind yields to it, absorbs it, and becomes conscious of just pain without any I feeling it or resisting it. It experiences pain in the same complete, unself-conscious way in which it experiences pleasure. Pain is the nature of this present moment, and I can only live in this moment. Sometimes, when resistance ceases, the pain simply goes away or dwindles to an easily tolerable ache. At other times, it remains. But the absence of any resistance brings about a way of feeling pain so unfamiliar as to be hard to describe. The pain is no longer problematic. I feel it, but there is no urge to get rid of it, for I have discovered that pain and the effort to be separate from it are the same thing. Wanting to get out of pain is the pain. It is not the reaction of an I distinct from the pain. When you discover this, the desire to escape merges into the pain itself and vanishes. Discounting aspirin for the moment, you cannot remove your head from a headache, as you can remove your hand from a flame. You equals head equals ache. When you actually see that you are the pain, pain ceases to be a motive, for there is no one to be moved. It becomes, in the true sense, of no consequence. It hurts, period. This, however, is not an experiment to be held in reserve as a trick for moments of crisis. It is a way of life. It means being aware, alert, and sensitive to the present moment always.